I think between the cloud and between all the software programs that are out there that do, in fact, allow companies to use these technologies to augment the productivity of workers, to make them more productive, not to get rid of them. I think all that adds up to the potential for the market to continue to do well. I've been talking about 5,400 on the S&P 500 by the end of the year. I've been talking about that for over a year, and now I got the problem of we're almost there, and it's the end of March, basically.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Stocks have delivered a great ride over the past year and a half. That's attracted retail investors back into the markets with a vengeance. Household equity ownership is currently near an all-time high. So does this bull market still have plenty of room left to run? And if so, then what are the skeptics misunderstanding? For insight, we've got the good fortune to turn to Dr. Ed Yardeni, president of Yardeni Research. Ed, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, Ed, I believe this is your first time on the new channel. Thank you so much for making your inaugural appearance here. Of course, you and I have talked many
Congratulations
times.
Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a great ride so far. And the fact that Ed Yardeni has agreed to come on the program is just going to bring us to even new heights.
Anytime, really.
Well, thank you. You might regret making that offer, but we'll run with it. I got a lot of questions for you about what's going on right now. I do want to acknowledge in the past several times that we spoke in 2023, you remained pretty sanguine about the outlook for the economy and the markets. Mm-hmm. And to date, I think you've been proven quite right on that. So first, I want to give you well-deserved props for your outlook and for sticking to your guns. I want to get into that and what you see lying ahead. But real quick, if we can just start with the general question I like to kick all of our discussions off with. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, I think it's great that you started off asking me that question, because as investors, we tend to be too U.S.-centric and not totally appreciate the fact that we do live in a small world, after all, as that ride in Disney sings. And I think when you look at the global situation, what you see is that the U.S. is doing really quite well compared to the rest of the world. And that's important because that has an impact on the dollar. It has an impact on commodity prices. Usually when the U.S. is doing better than the rest of the world, the dollar's doesn't go down. It either stays stable or it goes higher. The other thing is China is not doing well at all. China's over the past couple of years has gotten into a deeper and deeper depression in their property market. Their property bubble burst. A lot of Chinese people are big savers, and they buy stocks. They also bought a lot of apartments, and they had so-called ghost cities of these apartments were basically vacant. They weren't even rented out. And they viewed that as a part of their wealth. And now they've got this huge negative so-called wealth effect where both their stock portfolios and their property portfolios are down. So that's depressing consumer spending in China. And as a result of that, the Chinese government has tried to stimulate consumer spending, can't seem to get it going. So they are continuing to push the old model of manufacturing for export. And that's creating a lot of deflation in the global goods markets, merchandise markets. We're seeing that, for example, in a decline in import prices from goods we buy from China in the United States. And so that's important for understanding why inflation has come down. You know, a lot of people were pessimistic over the past couple of years because they felt that the only way the Federal Reserve could possibly bring inflation down was with a recession. And they were right. They got the wrong country. We didn't have to have one here because the Chinese did it for us. And they've been a major source of deflation in the goods market. Services, obviously, is a whole different story. But the service inflation rate is also gradually coming down. Europe is in a shallow recession. So when you add it all up, it's a global economy that's kind of, muddling along with the U.S. economy chugging along. I mentioned the U.S., Europe and China. Emerging markets, many of them are commodity producers, like Brazil, for example, Indonesia, another example. And in that kind of global, relatively weak environment, commodity prices are probably going to remain relatively depressed, relatively low. And that also is contributes to weakness in the global economy.
Okay. So U.S. chugging along, rest of world kind of muddling along. It sounds like you're saying we got the recession we were looking for to bring down inflation. We were just able to kind of put that monkey on someone else's back, right?
Correct. Yep. Absolutely.
Do you think the U.S. has dodged the bullet here? Like, or is there a piper to be paid in the future, or did we literally sort of manage to evade this?
Well, as you probably know, I am biased to being an optimist. And maybe it's because I had a happy childhood. I don't know what it is, but I think part of it is pessimism is so in fashion these days that I try to be balanced. And by trying to be balanced in an environment where so many smart people doing so much, you know, heavy duty analysis of what could go wrong, I find myself being labeled as the optimist, as the permeable, simply because I'm trying to provide some balance. So yeah, I understand all that. I mean, we could spend, you know, the time we have left, and I could bury you with how everything is going to absolutely fall apart, but it wouldn't be anything unique or original from what maybe some of your other guests have been saying. So I know their story. I think if you ask the pessimist to tell my story, that they may know it, but, you know, it would be hard for them to tell it because, you know, they wouldn't believe it. I think that what we're looking at for the United States is an environment where we have to understand what it is that caused recessions. And when you look at it, the recession since 1960, what you come to realize is it's a process that leads to a recession. Monetary policy starts to tighten because inflation is a problem either in goods markets and services markets or in asset markets. So the Fed starts to tighten. And somewhere along the way, the yield curve inverts, the bond yield falls below the short-term rate. That's a signal that bond investors saying, you know what, I'm going to buy a bond at 4%, even though a 10-year bond at 4%, even if I can get 5% in a 2-year, because if the Fed just goes any further here, something's going to break and then they'll have to ease. And so let's not try to be too cute about calling the exact top when interest rates peak. Let's conclude that it's getting close. And so the yield curve did in fact invert a couple of years ago, and it did in fact get it right. We got a financial crisis, just as previous yield curves have correctly anticipated. This time it was a mini crisis in the banking sector. In March of 2023, the Fed came in with a very impressive liquidity facility. They learned how to play whack-a-mole back during the great financial crisis. They created one liquidity facility after the other. It doesn't always keep us out of a credit crunch and a recession, but it certainly worked last year. And so we haven't had a credit crunch, and therefore we haven't had a recession. It's credit crunches that cause recessions, and it's financial crisis that kind of trigger and lead up to these credit crunches. So I don't see a scenario like that, not if the Fed has learned how to play whack-a-mole in the credit markets. In fact, I don't think that the Fed really needs to lower interest rates here. There's a lot of people who think that the Fed needs to lower interest rates because if they don't, that'll cause a recession. And I think while it is true that the Fed has tightened monetary policy dramatically, if you look at the Fed funds rate going from zero to 5.25% in a matter of 2 years, I think it's also important to realize that they've actually normalized. The abnormality is not 4% 10-year bond yield today. It was, you know, a bond yield of 0.5% in the midst of the pandemic. So, look, I'm not going to tell you we're never going to have a recession again. We obviously will. I do worry about, you know, it's not just credit crunches that cause recessions. In our lifetime, we've also seen spikes in oil prices, energy crises that cause recessions. And that's still a possibility with the insanity going on in the Middle East. So far, amazingly, it hasn't caused oil prices to spike up to 100 and higher. But I have been noticing of late, as we all have, that the price of oil, the price of gasoline has been going up for the past few months. And I think there is a Middle East war premium in the oil market. And I hope it doesn't get into a situation where, first of all, obviously, like everybody else, I wish it that there'd be some sort of peaceful resolution of all these crazy things that are killing so many people. But at the same time, as an investment strategist, I have to be realistic and say that, you know, there is a risk that this turns into another energy crisis, in which case we would probably suffer a recession.
Okay. So kind of what I hear you saying, Ed, is look, there's a lot of things that could derail the economy and force a market correction in here. But you're not seeing anything that's sort of an imminent threat, and you kind of feel like,
no.
You know, until you see something that looks like that, it's going to be status quo.
Well, you know, the other thing I should mention, you know, I like to compare decades. Now, if I can get a decade right, I feel pretty good. I guess actually, if I can get a year right, I feel pretty good. In the past couple of years, I feel pretty good, having been optimistic. But you know, I could be wrong. It happens. From time to time, to everybody who's a forecaster. I think there are similarities with the 1920s, and that's really my base case, is that this will, by the end of the decade, we'll look back, you know, started out awfully scary, but it basically turned out to be the roaring 2020s. And the analogy is with technology and productivity, tremendous technological innovations in the 1920s. Same thing now. I think the stock market started to discount the roaring 2020 scenario. I'll tell you, I have the exact date. November 30th, 2022 is when OpenAI first introduced ChatGPT. And there's been lots of excitement about artificial intelligence and how that could increase productivity. And in fact, productivity has been increasing at a better rate. Had a very good year last year. So it could be the 2020s. It could also be the 1970s, as we just discussed. If we have a second energy crisis, I think that could possibly cause a recession. And then another analogy is the 1990s, in which we had a technology-led bubble in the stock market that burst, and then we had a recession for a while with a pretty terrible bear market for quite some time. And it could be that we may be seeing too much hype in AI. We may be seeing too much money being thrown into technology, and that may set the stage for a speculative bubble in the stock market. If it is the 1990s, though, I think we're closer to December 5th, 1996 than the end of 1999. December 5th, 1996 is when Alan Greenspan, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, famously asked the question. He just asked the question, how do we know if we're looking at irrational exuberance in the stock market? I and a lot of other people are asking that right now. Forward PE of 21 on the S&P 500 is quite high. So we could have another scenario for a recession, and that is we have a, you know, let's party like it's 1999, you know, Prince's famous song. And if we do that and we see a melt up in the stock market, then we'd have to worry about a meltdowns and a recessionary environment. You know, melt ups can be a lot of fun if you remember to get out at the top.
It can be fun on the way up. All right. So you touched on a number of things that I want to ask you about in a little more depth. And I'm really not, my job here is I'm not trying to ask leading questions. I'm just trying to ask questions for you to give your perspective on. And
I appreciate that. Sure.
I do want to get to the question at the end of this, which is, so what are the bears missing here? Because as you said, there are lots of different things that could happen. And a number of the decades you just mentioned didn't end well. I was going to get to here, but since you just mentioned it, why don't we start here, right? Which is your party like it's 1999 scenario. We have a market that has been on fire really for the past year and a half, but it kicked into overdrive in November of last year. Yep. Right? I think the S&P is up over 1,000 points since then, so over 25% in just the past 4.5 months. Yep. But that rise is being driven by a dwindling number of stocks. right? And it's largely being powered by the Mag 7, now the Mag 5 or 4 or 3, depending on who you're talking to in any given day. NVIDIA is the lead sled dog driving that. And on any given day, the price to sales for that company is somewhere between 30 and 40 times. So, you know, you said if this was sort of like a 90s decade, you're thinking it might be closer to 96 than end of 99. But man, when you have ratios like that, they yeah. are pretty hard to defend sure. intellectually. And look, markets can, melt-ups can go super far. But how worried are you, right? Or I shouldn't ask that leading question. What is your opinion right now of the valuations of the stocks driving this market? And what do you feel about the market breadth as a sign of health?
Yeah, well, I'm a reasonable person. They're not cheap. they were a lot cheaper a year, 2 years ago for sure. So valuations are stretched. And I would point out, though, that the notion that it's been a fairly narrow bull market is not quite right. I've seen some people take the ratio of the S&P 500 equal weighted index and divide it by the S&P 500 market cap weighted index and say, look, it's going down. The market's going up on a narrower or falling ratio. And I point out, you know what? It's just that a few stocks have done so incredibly well that a piddling 20% increase in some of these other areas of the market looks like chump change. But it's been a bull market pretty much across the board in the market. There have been plenty of areas of the market that have performed extremely well, just not like superbly well, as we've seen some of the AI-related stocks. So you take out the big cap technology names, and you get a multiple of about 18, which isn't cheap either. Historically, 15 seems to be the fair value view of the marketplace. I don't want to say it's different this time, but there are some differences, and that is, I believe that the technology revolution we're experiencing now has the potential to increase productivity in a whole host of businesses, not just a few. The technology revolution that started out at the beginning and that occurred in the 1990s basically provided Word and Excel as software that allowed some companies to increase their productivity in the secretarial pool. You wouldn't need a lot of people on Selectric typewriters anymore if everybody's doing their own documents, writing their own documents on Word. And if you had a whole bunch of bookkeepers, you could use Excel. But other than that, there wasn't a lot of productivity impact on the rest of the economy. This time around, I think between the cloud and between all the software programs that are out there that do in fact allow companies to use these technologies to augment the productivity of workers, to make them more productive, not to get rid of them, I think all that adds up to the potential for the market to continue to do well. I've been talking about 5,400 on the S&P 500 by the end of the year. I've been talking about that for over a year, and now I got the problem of we're almost there, and it's the end of March basically. So I'm starting to talk about, well, yeah, but I think it's still a bull market. There could be a correction along the way here. But there could also be a melt-up along the way here. I mean, the market has beat my expectations, and I've been sort of on the high bullish side for the past couple of years, and the market keeps running past me to achieve my levels by the middle of the year or earlier. So I think it's still a bull market that can carry us for the next couple of years. Bull markets don't just, you know, suddenly end unless there's a recession. And I, again, barring a real calamity in the Middle East that leads to a spike in oil prices, which causes a recession, I don't see it. If, on the other hand, we have a melt-up scenario in the market, there could be a bursting of a speculative bubble down the road that leads to a recession. But before that happens, the market's going to go a lot higher.
Okay. And I recently saw your forecast for the S&P. If I can just confirm them for you to make sure these are sure. still your current forecasts. It was 5,400 for end of this year, which you just said. 6,000 for year end 2025 and 6,500 for 2026. And I know these are finger to the winds, but is that still more or less?
Yeah, I'm still sticking with that. I mean, it conveys my basic view that I think there's not likely to be a recession. And if that's the case, we're going to be in a bull market until there really is a recession. I mean, we did have a bear market in 2020. We did have a bear market in 2020 that didn't last very long when the Fed came in. But we also had another bear market in 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine, and then everybody started thinking about a recession. So you can't have a bear market without a recession. That's very unusual. And this time around, I think it's not likely we'll have a bear market unless there really is a reason to anticipate a recession.
Okay. All right, I'm going to ask you about components of the economy and where it's headed and you know whether there's recessionary implications or not. Real quick, though, I guess since we're here, so you expect the markets to go up pretty much for the next 3 years straight. What asset classes and or investing strategies do you favor given this outlook? Do you think some will do, there are sectors that will do better than others? Will it be kind of like the post 2010 era where just sort of all boats rose?
Well, in this environment, I kind of like them all. I mean, I've been recommending technology, financials, industrials as overweight positions. I know materials have done well recently, but I don't see that the global economy is going to be red hot and lead to higher commodity, any sort of sustainable increase in commodity prices. I have liked energy, which hasn't worked out very well until recently, as a hedge against the kind of geopolitical risk that still exists in the Middle East. And so I think those would still be, and I've been promoting those for the past couple of years, and where technology has been number one, and technology includes communication services, obviously. So I would stick with those, but the laggards like healthcare, I think you'll see some improvement there, some catching up. I think recently it's done better. And I do think the mid caps, the small and mid cap stocks will perform better. But so far the problem with the mid caps is analysts aren't really getting that excited about their earnings prospects, which I think is what's holding them down. So we've got to see better action there. You know, one of the problems we're having is that the big technology companies and others that have a tremendous amount of cash are buying up all the good companies before they go public.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, startups would go to the capital markets, they go public, and they turn into Microsoft. And these days, these little companies get bought up by Microsoft, and you never see them other than through the income statement and balance sheet of Microsoft. So that may be part of the issue. I'm not a big fan of looking at the Russell 2000, which is small caps, because it's got a lot of companies that have no earnings. I much prefer the S&P 600, which is the small caps index of 600. There's also the S&P 400 for the mid caps. You know, one of the hottest sectors has been actually technology in the mid cap area of the marketplace. So that I think there's still opportunities in the market.
Okay, still a lot of opportunities. On the point you just mentioned about the big companies buying up smaller private companies, I'd just love to get your thoughts on this observation. I interviewed a private equity guy about a year ago, and he was saying, look, you want to look at private equity because sort of as you were saying, back in the old days, if you wanted to scale, you had to go tap the public markets. That was the only way to get that much capital. But now the private markets are becoming so deep that you have companies out there. He was mentioning SpaceX as a really good example, right? A company that just has to spend gargantuan amount of capital before it ever gets to a point of sustainable profitability. And he's like, there's no way you could ever launch a company like that without tapping the private, the public markets in the past, but now it's so far at least remaining private. So his kind of point was the growth is increasingly going private because you don't have the hassles of being a public corporation, right? Right. And then now, as you're saying, and there's makes maybe a fat buyout somewhere in there too at some point. So do you kind of have a long-term concern that sort of the best investments are now not going to be available to the public markets?
Yeah, I think that's what I was getting at with regards to the mid caps, is that the real cream of the crop don't ever get to the public market. So that is an issue. That doesn't mean that there aren't good companies in the public sector, but I think it is an issue, and maybe that's why the large caps are going to continue to outperform their smaller cap the smaller cap companies. By the way, I would also point out it's not just that there's more money in private capital; there's more money also in distressed asset managers, which is also a form of private capital. And that's one of the reasons I think that the U.S. it's a shock absorber for the United States. When things go really wrong in commercial real estate, somebody's going to lose a lot of money. As long as it's not a bank and it's just a portfolio in an insurance company or somewhere else, it's not a disaster. And meanwhile, somebody else can pick it up for 25 cents on the dollar, and they've got the money to turn it around. You know, I've heard of a mall in Texas that was went out of business, and somebody bought it real cheap and made a pickleball facility out of it that's doing extremely well. So, you know, Americans are, I think one of the things that America really does have that is unique in the financial realm is a very, very well-developed capital market, private equity, distressed asset managers. They provide a tremendous amount of liquidity to the system. But at the end of the day, while investors may miss some opportunities that otherwise would have occurred, you wind up investing with the companies that have the cash that are buying up the good ideas, and you'll participate to a certain extent. You can almost look at some of these big cap names as venture funds. They're investing in the companies for you.
Yeah. You know, you've probably seen the same charts I have, Ed, that show that the leaders of the Dow or the you know, dominant indices in one decade tend to not be the leaders in the next decade, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a time when, you know, it was all banks. There was a time when it was all energy companies. Right now, it's all tech. And it feels when you're in that era, like these companies are never going to be displaced. Yeah. Do you feel like it's a little bit different this time, that these companies have gotten so big and they're now, like you said, like venture arms, and are they more entrenched now than they've been in previous decades, or should we just sort of not have the hubris that today's different?
I think it's possible that you know, all these companies will still be around in 10, 20, 30 years. I think Jeff Bezos famously was on 60 Minutes one time and predicted that Amazon would not be around at some point. I know that the head of NVIDIA has said that he manages his company like it's going to go out of business tomorrow. And so, I mean, if you got leaders of companies who are doing the best they can to continue to grow and move forward and to innovate, then they'll probably continue to do that. Some of them, like Facebook, are still owned or managed by their founders, companies where their founders are still in charge and have succeeded in making these companies big, tend to continue to have that aspiration and achieve it. So I think there's something to be said for that. You know, I'll say this with taking the risk that, you know, it'll be dead wrong, but I think that all companies are technology companies now. That means you either use it or you either make it or you use it. You don't use it, you're going to lose it. You're going to go out of business. companies have to use technology. And again, in the 1990s, you didn't have to use technology because there wasn't a lot that really you could use other than Word and Excel. And that was a fairly limited use. Now, artificial intelligence didn't just come around recently. It's been around for a while. I would argue that, you know, Siri and Alexa are a form of artificial intelligence. I'll be more excited about artificial intelligence when I can actually have a conversation with these ladies and ask them to make a phone call for me or make an appointment for me. That's where my kind of question of artificial intelligence comes in. Is that at my level, I'm not really seeing it yet, but I think at the company level, they're going to be able to. Every company that has a lot of data that's internal, I think they're going to be able to use that data with artificial intelligence to manage their business a lot better. I think artificial intelligence that's kind of open-ended and gets its information from the internet is going to get increasingly polluted with garbage that it creates itself. It'll start sourcing itself, saying, well, you know, this article is where I got this information from, and it'll turn out to be some article that another AI program wrote. So I think you have to be careful about recognizing that artificial intelligence is artificial, it's not intelligent. I think we're spending billions of dollars that will, in fact, lead to not more intelligent, but less error-prone AI. When, by the way, is a personal story. I think that artificial intelligence first got discounted, or this, let's make it broader, that the Roaring 2020s got discounted, started to be discounted back on November 30th, 2022. That's when OpenAI introduced their ChatGPT. So 1 week later, I signed up for the $20 a month version. A few months later, I canceled, because I thought, you know, I'd be able to just have this thing work for me and do all my work, and so I wouldn't have to work so hard. And it turned out that I had to spend more time correcting its errors. And I said, I might as well just write it myself. So my personal experience hasn't been all that gung-ho on AI, but I'm sure that companies that keep that have huge, vast amounts of information and data will be able to use it within their proprietary domains and get tremendous productivity gains from them.
All right. So many layers of this onion I want to peel, looking at the time.
It'll make you cry.
You know, well, first off, you've given us your targets of ever rising, you know, stocks for the next 3 years. I just want to draw a parallel between the AI driven promise today and the promise of the internet back in 1999, right? And this all goes to the price is what you pay, value is what you get, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of companies that ended up doing great, perform like income statement performance wise, cash flow performance wise in the several decades following 1999. But the stock prices were just at astronomical levels back then.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, it wasn't a good value. Right. And you know, that's why it took the NASDAQ so long to heal from the dot-com crash. What's your level of concern that may be going on today?
Well, I don't see too many dot-coms. I mean, I don't see companies that are just harebrained ideas that attract the first round of financing. And then when they need the second round, the investors say, this was a harebrained idea. I don't know why I gave you any money in the first place. And these things all blew up. And meanwhile, with the first round of funding, they bought all these computers and software and created the technology demand boom. In addition, companies like Cisco and some of the other telecom companies went on a buying binge. They bought each other. Cisco bought a lot of companies. And a lot of the telecom companies engaged in seller financing, which is not a good long-term strategy. You can always get somebody to buy your product if you lend them money, and eventually they wind up stiffing you. But when they do stiff you, that's when that whole model blows up. And then let's not forget Y2K, There was a perception that you had to spend a lot of money on technology in order to avoid that problem. And it turned out to be a great excuse for doing just that. And so when the millennium clock turned, guess what? There were no problems. By the way, back then, it was one of my most serious forecasting error. I thought there might be a recession. There was, but it wasn't for the reasons I thought. It was because companies bought all the technology they wanted and then they didn't want anymore. It wasn't because anything stopped working. But all those things, I don't see them in the current environment. I do see that billions of dollars are being thrown at R&D, not at, buying another dot-com with no concept whatsoever. I mean, it's good to see that some of the bubbles that we had only a couple of years ago, like the SPAC bubble, like the bubble in the meme stocks, those bubbles seem to have burst without any economic consequence whatsoever. So I think the analogy is not a perfect one between the current environment and the 1990s. And these big companies, Apple decided that they're not going to do cars after all.
Yep.
And so apparently they blew a few billion dollars on that product, but you wouldn't know it looking at its stock price or, anybody's concerns about that. And quite the opposite. People think, well, if they tried it and they didn't like it and they walked away from it, that leaves them with $1 billion that they could spend on something else that might actually be worthwhile. Everybody's waiting to see how Apple is going to get into the AI business. But I think it's pretty simple. You start selling phones that have some AI features and it's a whole new iPhone. So I think that's really what Apple's going to do, is they're going to say, now we have AI in our iPhones, and say, well, I want the latest version of this thing.
Right.
I can hardly wait for Siri to actually be a personal assistant.
Okay, so sounds like you're bullish just on the technology and where it could go. You believe we're already seeing a productivity benefit from it, and you didn't say this, but I'm assuming you're seeing a tailwind of that going on for the foreseeable future. And it sounds like you think the capital that is entering this space is being allocated more intelligently, efficiently than it was back in the .com, just throw money at anything with .com at the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, back then the driving force was the internet. This time the driving force is artificial intelligence. But I think there's more money being thrown at R&D now than there was being thrown into the internet. It was really more into companies that claimed that they could use the internet to do all sorts of neat things.
All right. Last point on this, then I'm going to try to get to some of these other topics in the time we have. Again, I'm just going to go back to NVIDIA and its price to sales ratio here, right? We can argue whether NVIDIA is going to continue growing at the rate it needs to earn that price to sales ratio. And of course, there's concerns about competitors coming into the market and all that type of stuff. I guess my question is just, if again, looking back at the internet, it took a while for the value to be unlocked by that new technology to really manifest itself. And I guess the question is even if the current expectation of the massive size of the AI opportunity is here, how much of that future value are we pulling into today, where, at 30 or 40 times sales, famously, like, the company in theory has to return everything to investors for the next 30 years without having any expenses, right? Again, it goes back to sort of the price and the value thing. And I'm asking this in the context of your 3-year projections. Like, maybe do we get up to 7,000 on the S&P, but then we realize we got crazy and we go back down to 4,500 for a while, but yeah, we end the year at 6,000.
Yeah, I think AI is going to have to deliver some tangible results that actually make a difference to earnings. I mean, right now it's kind of like what we did see in the 1990s, which was the technology companies that made PCs and provided the software. They're the ones that saw their stock prices really soar, and the impact on the earnings and productivity of everybody else wasn't as obvious. As a matter of fact, we had a huge productivity boom, the growth boom in the late 1990s. And that wasn't because technology was making productivity better. It was technology was just producing a lot more Dell boxes with Microsoft software in them. And I remember I was at on Wall Street at the time, and the firm I was working with, I had to be very careful walking down the hall not to trip over a Dell box. Everybody suddenly, you know, for a while there, you know, getting a laptop or a PC was like, you know, only for the, you know, the top stars. And then all of a sudden everybody was getting it. And then everybody got it. And once everybody got it, that was the end of the productivity boom.
Right.
And productivity really fizzled big time. So there were really no long-term consequences of the initial technology boom of the internet and Intel and Microsoft and all that. And I guess it's possible here, but here what's different is, I think first and foremost is the cloud. The cloud is really the huge productivity event of the past several years, because in the past you'd have to have hundreds of people in an IT department in order to maintain your PCs with updated software and fix things. This time around, one IT person working out of anywhere can operate remotely and help you do what you need to fix. And the cloud now actually allows for programs to be rented rather than sold because they get updated automatically. So we're constantly getting better and better software automatically without anybody having to install it. I view artificial intelligence as just the continuation of the technology revolution that started in the 1990s. It's just making it better and better. And it's all about computing. It's all about speed of light. And I think what NVIDIA's chips do is, you know, first they started out in gaming, then they went to Bitcoin, and then they realized that they can take those very same chips and lead to much faster computing with those chips. People are working on quantum computing now. If that technology ever takes off in a big time and becomes cost effective, that could put these GPU chips out of business. But maybe NVIDIA will invest in some company that revolutionizes the quantum computing technology, which has been promising for a long time to be the fastest, but has yet to actually deliver. But it's, you know, it could be the next new thing. But for now, you know, there are some companies like NVIDIA that have had huge runs, and maybe they're going to have some comeuppance. But, you know, the head of NVIDIA has a few times said that the way he manages his company is as though it's going to go out of business tomorrow. So at least he doesn't have the ego of thinking that, you know, they've got the technology that they can sell to the rest of us forever. Quite the opposite. They're spending a lot of money on the next iteration, the next generation of their technology. So if these companies are running basically scared, that they know that if they don't innovate, somebody else will and will put them out of business. Look at Facebook. You know, he kind of, Zuckerberg kind of went off in the metaverse direction and started spending too much money in that area. And the stock market punished him, and he doesn't like to lose that much wealth in such a short period of time. He said, all right, you want to see me make money? I'll show you how I make money. I just cut my costs and, you know, ramp up where I'm productive and move forward and continue to invest in other technologies without kind of going wild. So they're always, these tech companies are always throwing spaghetti on the wall to see what sticks. And they've got the cash flow. They're not as dependent on borrowing. So they are unique. You're not going to find them anywhere else in the world. I mean, it's really amazing when we talk about the Magnificent Seven, they're American companies. But, you know, NVIDIA, by the way, comes up with the ideas and then to actually produce them. They go to Taiwan. They have Taiwan Semi manufacture these things. So, you know, there are a lot of innovators out there, and they are having an impact on, I think they are having and will have an impact on productivity and therefore our earnings, and that drives the market. So again, I say this with some trepidation that, you know, I'm going to make a top here, but, you know, maybe 15 isn't the fair value multiple for the market anymore. Maybe it's more like, you know, something like 18. I know the market's selling at 21, but if you take out the Magnificent Seven, it's selling around 18 because companies are going to benefit from using these technologies. They have to use the technology to increase their productivity. If they don't, somebody else will.
Okay. So you're optimistic about the AI wave and the transformative effect that that's going to have. And maybe that does argue for a permanently higher multiple than historic for the market because all companies are going to be using AI. I understand that. Let's get to the cost side for a second. This is one of the questions I've been trying to get to, but you just keep giving such great answers. I want to let you run. You talked about the surprise with which I think everybody has had that the cost of capital is now an awful lot higher than it was during the ZIRP era. And yet the economy is chugging along here in the U.S., right? Yep. Another question I want to ask you, if we have time, is the role of liquidity, of net liquidity flows, because most of the people I've talked to, their reason for explaining how we've avoided a recession to date has been that actual net liquidity flows have been positive basically since about October of 2022. And that's what created the market bottom. And that's what powered everything basically since. But where I'm going with this is we have, you know, a lot of companies that are staring at this debt maturity wall. Right, not necessarily the top tech companies that are very cash rich and debt low, but a large part of the rest of the corporate fleet. And I heard you say earlier, like, yeah, whatever, like maybe, you know, rates have normalized and maybe we can hang out here longer. Yeah. And my question is explain to me how, especially when debt levels, both nationally, corporate-wise and household-wise, generally, and painting with a broad brush here, are just much higher than they were back when this was a more normal cost of capital for us.
Well, look, the bearish story that certainly is not consistent with the roaring 2020s, but it's a much more dire outlook. Is that we're going to have a debt crisis. Ray Dalio has been talking about a debt crisis for a couple of years, and last year seemed to be talking as though it's imminent, and it certainly felt like a debt crisis last year between August and November 1st when we saw the bond yield jump from 4.25% to 5%. I coined the phrase the bond vigilantes back in the early 80s, and all of a sudden I'm getting calls from reporters all over the place. The bond vigilantes back. And I said, yeah, it looks like they're back, but I think there's going to be some rate at which they'll be buying again. And it turned out to be 5%. And here we are back at, you know, around 4.25%, which is the kind of bond yield level, the 10-year bond yield level that we saw before the great financial crisis. The real abnormality was the period between the great financial crisis and the great virus crisis. When central banks were obsessed with getting inflation up to 2% and felt that they have to have ultra easy monetary policy. But the answer to your question about liquidity is a funny variable. I don't know how to measure it. I guess you could look at M2 or you could look at the money market funds. You know, there are different measures of liquidity, but it's a funny variable. It's like, I always find that when the stock market's going down, all of a sudden everybody's telling you liquidity dried up. Then when it's going up, suddenly, oh, well, we got all this liquidity out there. And well, what about some of the fundamentals? What if, like, well, maybe the market went up because investors suddenly realized we're not going to have a recession after all. I mean, the fundamentals certainly suggested that we had a very, very mild earnings recession, and it was really just a profit margin recession. Revenues kept going on to all-time record highs. But I am worried about those things I worry about. I worry about the Middle East and oil prices going up. I worry about this monthly chart that we're all looking at on the amount of interest that the government has to pay on its huge debt. Every month that number keeps going up. It's bigger than defense spending probably by now. But I try to be balanced, and I point out that it's called debt interest outlays of the federal government. Outlays tend to be stimulative, and somebody's getting that interest. Somebody bought those bonds, they're getting the interest, and that's actually been stimulative. I'm thinking that, yeah, the debt to GDP ratio of the government is going to go higher and higher. But if we get better than expected growth based on productivity and maybe lower than expected inflation, maybe the bond yield settles back down below 4%. And maybe we find that the debt to GDP ratio doesn't go up as much because we do, in fact, generate some earnings. We saw on November 1st of last year, when the bond yield got to 5%, that Bill Ackman, who made a lot of money being short, said, you know, I made enough, I'm getting out. That very same day, Jerome Powell gave a press conference and sounded more dovish. But what really happened, most importantly on November 1st, is Janet Yellen. I went to Yale, I got a PhD at Yale. She did it six years earlier. I'm not that smart, so fortunately, she made some Xerox notes that we all cribbed from afterwards. And so she got me through the PhD program there. So I owe her a lot. Smart lady. And she's no fool. She saw that the bond vigilantes were acting up again. And she basically said, you don't like my bonds, I'll give you bills. And so she started issuing a lot more bills and fewer bonds. And maybe we're just going to find that the government operates by issuing bills. And we don't have the bond vigilantes to worry about in that scenario. Look, I've been doing this for a lot of years and for, you know, over 40 years. And over that entire period, people have been predicting that the deficit, the debt are going to take us down. Hasn't happened so far. But it's the amount of debt is insane. There's no doubt about that. And I'll worry about it when the bond market's worrying about it. I was worried in August, September, October last year. And then suddenly I wasn't worried about it because 5% worked and inflation came down as I expected. And that got the bond investors back in. So, yeah, you got to put that on the worry list. There's no way I can put lipstick on that pig. I can't make everything look good here. I try to be balanced. And in this case, I got nothing good to say about it. Larry Fink, in his recent annual report, spent a lot of time on the irresponsible federal government and the amount of debt. But on the other hand, it's clearly been a stimulative, one of the reasons we haven't had a recession, because the government is still spending a lot of money on infrastructure. There's a lot of incentives for onshoring. So you got to factor that in.
All right. In just the last couple minutes we have, I just want to touch on a topic we touched on at the end of our last talk, which is the growing wealth divide, I'd say, in this country, but I don't think it's limited to the U.S. And since what you just called the great virus crisis, which maybe that's what they will call the COVID pandemic era going forward, since then we saw this explosion in inflation and really in cost of living. For a long time, real wages were negative, right? We are back to positive wage growth now. Positive real wage growth, but that growth rate is declining now again. I don't have the survey in front of me here. I had it in a past interview, but something like 2/3 of households say that their wages have not kept up with their cost of living. Right. So we've seen, I would say, a pinching of the middle and working classes, pretty serious one over the past couple of years. The the policies that have been implemented and just the way in which the system is now working is, you know, if you're one of the few on a relative basis percent of Americans that own financial assets, you're doing great now, right? Yeah. Because, you know, the market's basically saved your bacon over the past year and a half, right? So you're doing great. Whereas the average person doesn't have a lot of exposure to the stock market. And they've been getting squeezed, increasingly squeezed, the way that I've said. And we had a wealth gap issue before the pandemic hit, but it seems to have really poured more jet fuel on that fire.
Right.
How concerned are you about this? Because when I hear about the future that you talk about, it seems to me that those that own shares in all these companies are going to do great. And if productivity goes up due to technology, there is, in many cases, less of a need for humans, right? And so, you know, we can make some pretty dire projections. I don't want to say dire, but we can make some pessimistic projections about the labor force going forward, either because we go into recession and to cut costs, companies have to lay people off, or on the other side, because AI makes companies realize I don't need to hire as many people, and people are expensive. And we have the precedent of X or Twitter, where, you know, Elon Musk got rid of 3/4 of the company and it's still working, right? So a lot of companies are like, wow, maybe I need to really reevaluate how many people I need.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why I come across as a perma bull and an optimist, is because stories like that are so well thought out and talked about that I find myself saying, well, that makes a lot of sense. But first of all, let's see what's going right here. I think when we're looking, before we look at wealth, let's look at income. And in order to have income, you have to have a job. The unemployment rate has been below 4% for the past 26 months. It's the longest stretch that we've had in decades. So we've got a fully employed economy. If you want a job, there are jobs out there. And the minimum wage has gone up a lot over the past couple of years. There has clearly been some writing improvement in nominal wages. You're absolutely right that inflation-adjusted wages went flat during the pandemic. But starting last year, inflation-adjusted wages have actually been going up to a record high. And when I talk about wages, I have two series. I have one for all workers, and I have one for what are called production and non-supervisory workers that accounts for 80% of the labor force. So you don't have the rich in there. You've got working stiffs like you and me. I don't know if some people would call us working stiffs working from home, but you know, people who are working, they're not at the top of the you know, they're not millionaires or billionaires. Their real wage is at an all-time record high. So, you know, people tend to be pessimistic when they're interviewed. There are a lot of interviews now where surveys would say that a lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck. I think some of this is missing the demography of what's going on here. And maybe I'm too much into the demography story. I'm a baby boomer. There's a lot of us. Maybe we're arrogant. I don't know. You know, there's the younger folks say, okay, boomer, as though we know it all and we really don't. But I'll tell you what I do know is that I'm still working for a living, and I just turned 74. A lot of my friends are retiring, and a lot of them own their own homes. You know that of all the homeowners out there, 40% of them don't have any mortgage at all. And a lot of them are the baby boomers. Their college expenses, they're behind them. Their assets, all-time record high. The baby boomers have $75 trillion in assets. That's half of the assets of all households in the country. So that gets me to conclude that a lot of the wealth has to do with what Spock said in Star Trek. You know, remember he raised his fingers like this, and he said, you know, live long and prosper. One of the reasons we have wealth and income inequality is because people are living longer. And a lot of them are the baby boomers, And they have accumulated a lot of income and wealth by buying houses, by buying stocks, with pensions, with life insurance, and so on. And the younger kids are struggling. But the younger kids are also, unless their parents spend it all, the younger kids are going to be inheriting a lot of dough. And again, I know this from experience. I know people my age, not my age, but younger people, but you know, and adults, older adults, their parents have gone and they're suddenly got a house on the lake. So there's a lot of that. So we've never, ever had a richer demographic situation that we have now. Wealth of the household sector, all-time record high, $155 trillion. Half of that with the baby boomers, $75 trillion. And that's another thing that the pessimists missed, is these people are retiring. They're spending money. They don't have any real serious expenses, so they can go on trips. They can go to restaurants every day. They can go check into the hospital and pay the copay. And guess where employment's been growing in all these areas? So that's helped to keep the economy growing. So the wealth story is a very complicated one. I'm not going to pretend or claim that everybody's doing great, but from the point of view of the macroeconomic data, GDP, all-time record high, inflation-adjusted consumption, all-time record high. I mean, you know, the rich are the so-called 1%. The 1% can't be spending that much on food and cars and all that. Consumption per household, all-time record high, adjusted for inflation. So I think things aren't that bad. They're not as bad as we're being led to believe. And, you know, there were some people saying that real wages have stagnated for decades. And when you actually look at the data, it's been going up 1.4% per year since 1995 on a consistent basis. And that's like a doubling in the standard of living over a 25-year period. So there's a lot of misinformation along those lines. But again, I'm not going to tell you there aren't people suffering, that there aren't people living paycheck to paycheck. But I do know from personal experience, having five kids, that some of them, you know, not being fully on their own, they're out of college, and that cost me a bundle. But there are a lot of parents my age helping their kids. And so if you ask them of my younger kids, two of my younger kids, you know, how's their money holding up from their salary? Say, I live paycheck to paycheck. They don't forget. They don't seem to remember that I'm paying some of the credit card bills.
Yeah. And isn't it funny that way? Yeah. When your kids tell you they're living independently and you're like, well, I think we need to figure out the definition of independent.
Yeah. Right? Independent. Exactly.
All right. Kind of where I wanted to dig in the question, and we're just going to have to punt for next time, Ed, but it's more kind of the difference of between the mean and the median. I think if you look at the mean, yeah, no doubt, we're still heading up into good territory. The question is do we have kind of a composition issue where, you know, things are concentrating and more people are feeling left out? And does that bring us towards some sort of social friction point? But
yeah, I think the social friction point is really that everything's been politicized. And it seems as though people are born with a left of center and a right of center DNA. And that I am very concerned about our domestic politics and how partisan it has become. But in terms of the economy, look, you mentioned before that as the economy becomes more productive, more technology, I don't think it displaces workers. I think it augments the knowledge, the productivity of workers. This productivity boom is based on brain rather than brawn. Past productivity booms have been all about, you know, being able to move things and lift things without manual effort. This productivity boom is all about making us smarter, faster, you know, think faster, and get information faster. And that's something that just makes people better at their work and enjoy it more. So I think that's a positive situation. And another point I want to make is real wages are tied in at the hip to productivity. On a consistent basis, you don't have an increase in real wages without productivity going up. So productivity increases real wages. Maybe it gets rid of some jobs, as you mentioned, But those, you know, we've got a very dynamic labor force. 200,000 people per week file for initial unemployment claims. That's a lot of, multiply that by 52 and you get a big number. So there's a lot of churn in our labor market, and there's a lot of job openings. And very often when people get fired or look for another job, they do it to get a better paying one.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Lots of questions still unaddressed. So Ed, I am going to have to take you up on your kind offer. We'll have you back on the program again at some point this year. Sure. And obviously if you see anything in your crystal ball that makes you change material, any of your forecasts that you've talked to us, the one you have back there, just let me know and come back on this program anytime you like. All right. So for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation, I didn't even get to my point of complimenting you on the fantastic charts that you put together over there at Yardeni.com. But for folks that would like to follow you in your work, where should they go?
Yeah, Yardeni.com is the homepage for the website. We have a product for institutional investors, which is pricey, I admit. Then we also have one for individual investors. You'll find it at Yardeni.com, but if you want to go there directly, it's YardeniQuickTakes.com, and it kind of shows the important relationship between the macroeconomic data that comes out on a daily basis and its impact on the financial markets and how the financial markets are anticipating the data and what we anticipate the markets will do. So you might find that of some interest, and both of them are available on a trial basis.
All right, fantastic. I highly recommend folks subscribe. I'm subscribed to the Quick Takes. And Ed, when I edit this, I'll put up the links to both of those prominently on the screen so folks know where to go. Folks, there'll be links in the description below this video as well. I got one last question for you, Ed, and that's that we've been talking about money and money-related topics this whole time. What's one non-money-related investment that you encourage folks to consider adopting in their lives? And while you chew on that, I'm just going to do 30 seconds of housekeeping here. Folks, if you've enjoyed having Ed on the program and would like to have him come back on when his crystal ball tells him something important is cooking, please let him know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. If you want to get my write-ups of all the interviews that we do on this channel, including this one here with Ed, just go subscribe to our Substack. Our premium Substack subscribers get those notes. That's just at adamtaggart.substack.com. And finally, if you want some help figuring out how to navigate your financial wealth through the whatever future may lie ahead, especially if it's as sanguine for the next 3 years as Ed thinks it may be, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just fill out the short form at thoughtfulmoney.com. These consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service that these advisors offer. And these are the same advisors that you see with me on this program week after week after week. All right, Ed, thanks so much. And wrapping up here again, let's get to that last question. What's one non-money related investment you would encourage folks to consider?
Well, folks covers a lot of people of different ages. So I can't answer the question. For younger people, I would say it has to be a money advice, and that is buy dividend yielding stocks, put them away and forget about them, or at least focus on companies where the dividends are rising. For older folks, on average, we're all living longer, enjoy life. If you can figure out how to enjoy retirement, traveling and having a good time with your spouses, do that, play golf. I don't play golf. I do play tennis. So I think I like the idea of working because I think it keeps your mind alert. So I think that's working actually is a health advice, in my opinion.
All right. So basically keep active, but really, really focus on savoring life. Because again, that's, at the end of the day, that's all we got. So make the most of it.
All there is.
All right, Ed, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.